Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune. And this week, the Second Amendment Foundation is sending letters to Utah cities pushing them to change the gun control laws on their books. So will local governments comply? In Salt Lake City, Police Chief Chris Burbank reveals that the officer who fatally shot a young man at a convenience store was wearing a body cam. Will the department release the video? The State Board of Education is in turmoil after several top employees resign and a board member calls for an investigation. Did the board misuse its power? And yet another deadline approaches in the legal wrangling between Vail and Park City Mountain Resort. Will the dispute settle before the snow flies? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we've got a ski resort nail biter, school board blues, gun lobbyists, UTA benefits, and much more. And joining me this morning, Tribune education reporter Lisa Schenker. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, City Hall reporter Christopher Smart. Chris,
hi,
welcome
Jennifer.
Back. Government and politics editor Dan Harry. Dan, hi there.
Good morning.
And from the opinion page, editorial writer George Pyle. George, good morning.
Good morning.
And you can join us too if there's a news story on your mind. You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments on the website sltrib.com. You can also give us a call live. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Dan, I'll start with you. The National Gun Lobby has come to Utah. They're targeting cities' gun control laws. What's the strategy of the Second Amendment Foundation?
Well, this is kind of an interesting strategy because instead of trying to challenge gun laws on constitutionality, which means you're, you know, eventually you're going to go all the way to the Supreme Court on those issues, which we've seen in recent years. They've decided to do a sort of a shortcut route. They're challenging all these city laws state by state based upon state, they call them preemption laws. And what that is the Utah legislature, like most legislatures around the country, have reserved most gun control law power to themselves. And they've told the local governments, you can't do anything more strict in terms of regulating firearms than the state law. And so they're combing through these city ordinances one by one, and they're seeing laws that don't conform with the state law, and they're writing these letters to all of these cities that they say are in violation, and they're demand letters, and they're basically threats to sue, although they're written in a very courteous way.
You reported this week that so far 49 cities have gotten the letters. How are Utah cities and towns reacting?
The ones that have responded so far mostly are quickly agreeing that they're going to amend their laws. They sometimes kind of they say, well, we don't believe that our ordinance is in violation of state law, but just in case, we'll change it anyway. And so they pretty much quickly change it. I know there was an interesting response from the Sandy City attorney who wrote back and said, I'm sure our city council respects the Second Amendment just as much as your organization does. So there's, you can kind of see they're sort of there're not a lot of people willing to cross the gun rights organization.
Interestingly, you were not able to get responses from a couple of cities that you would think would be very willing and ready to comment on the story.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed in two cities, Park City and Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City particularly because, you know, well, that's sort of the capital city here in the center of what we cover. But also because Mayor Ralph Becker is in line to be the head of the League of Cities. And, you know, in the past, this has gun rights and gun control has been a big issue for them. And I think that, you know, it's an ongoing debate among city mayors. So I would really like to get his take on it. And They said that his schedule just didn't allow him to talk to me. So, you know, I've put back in a request and said, okay, well, I wrote that story, but I'm still interested in talking to the mayor and interviewing about this subject. So we'll see where that goes. I don't know whether he just doesn't want to talk about the issue or whether he just really was awfully busy that couple of days.
All right, Mayor Becker, a request still in to talk about guns. You mentioned that if a city says, no, thank you, we're going to keep status quo, we're going to keep our gun control laws on the books, the Second Amendment Foundation will take them to court. So are cities prepared to pay? I mean, litigation's expensive.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's the kind of stick that the Second Amendment Foundation holds. Cities have a lot of expenses, you know, fixing potholes and lots of other things. And so this idea that they're going to go to court and spend taxpayer money on preserving a law, let's say, that bans guns in cemeteries, which, you know, how meaningful is that? I think it may be more symbolic than a practical concern. But, you know, there are ones that, you know, they talk about guns in parks, guns in daycare centers, guns in school facilities. So there are some issues there that touch very much to the heart of these issues of gun control.
State law, though, is favorable toward guns
very
here in
much
Utah.
So. Very much so, yes.
Tell us what we need to know about state gun laws.
Well, state gun laws, we are certainly one of the most gun-friendly states in the country. We were the first to designate a formal state gun. We have a very liberal concealed carry laws. And last year, the legislature passed a law that basically said we don't even need permits now to carry a concealed weapon. Any adult without a felony conviction can do it. And they passed that law, and the governor ended up vetoing it. They did not override his veto, but they did pass that law. So that gives a pretty clear picture of where Utah is at as far as gun control is concerned.
George Pyle, how will the Second Amendment Foundation's effort, this push to change city laws, how is that going to affect the gun conversation at the Capitol, do you think?
Well, I mean, as Dan says, I mean, the state legislature sets the laws, and then the question is whether if a city adds restrictions, if it says you can't carry a gun in a cemetery or a public building someplace that the state law is either permissive or silent on, then they'll say, well, that conflicts with state law, so you have to change it. I mean, the gun rights lobby controls the legislature already, and probably the only thing the legislature might do is make it more explicit in state law that, no, cities, you can't make a different law. This is the law for every square inch of the state of Utah, no matter what town you're in. These are the rules. And there is an argument to be made that this is an important public safety issue and the laws should be uniform, so that you, especially like in Salt Lake Valley, where you can't hardly tell what town you're in just by driving down the street, and the law in Murray shouldn't necessarily be different from the law in Salt Lake City and the law in South Salt Lake and the law in North Salt Lake. One of the big constitutional issues is that people have a right to know when they're breaking the law and when they're not. The law needs to be clear. And for the state to come along and say, okay, this is the law for the whole state, and we've made this decision through the democratic process at the legislature with your elected representatives, so these are the rules. Constitutionally, that makes perfect sense. And there are a lot of cities, and you know, Park City and Salt Lake City may be among them, who might have the wherewithal and the willingness and the money to fight one of these lawsuits if the Second Amendment Foundation brings it. I mean, for one thing, they're not Utahns. They're not constituents of these cities. Now, they could probably find a local plaintiff, but then you have the same argument that when the Sierra Club or the Audubon Society comes in from Washington or New York and says, Utah, you ought to behave in this and so way, and we say, well, you're not Utahns. You're not our constituents. How dare you tell us what to think? Second Amendment Foundation comes in from Washington, D.C., with no local chapter, as far as I can tell, and we all say, oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Whatever you say, sir. Where do we sign? And that's just the politics of it.
To just give a minor correction, they're actually centered in Bellevue, Washington.
Oh, so, pardon. Sorry.
Washington.
Washington,
whatever.
Yeah, they are very different, and the people in one don't necessarily like being compared to the people in the other.
Dan, Harry, I mean, is guns going to be an election issue this year?
No. No, it's not. Nobody in this state runs on gun control. It's just not what you do in this state.
All right. Speaking of guns, we're going to move on to an incident that happened in South Salt Lake by a Salt Lake City police officer shooting a young man at a convenience store. Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank meets with reporters for an hour-long session this week. And the big news to come out of that is that the shooting of Dylan Taylor was filmed. The police officer was wearing a body cam. So, Chris Marr, why did the chief say that he's not going to release the video at this point?
Well, first of all, the incident is being investigated by South Salt Lake. So during the investigation, the chief thinks it's highly improper for him to be releasing what's likely to be key evidence in the case before the investigation is even complete, let alone adjudicated. So I'm hopeful that the public will eventually see this video, although I don't think it'll be very soon. The other thing is that this video may be very helpful, but we don't know, and we won't know until we see it, that it tells the whole story of the incident. The friends and family of the victim say he was not armed. The police have not said whether he's armed. But the police chief did try to draw a contrast between this case and what's going on in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, where we saw an unarmed black man being shot by a white cop and, you know, a week of rioting.
This all comes out from Chief Burbank, but it's not very satisfying to at least Dylan Taylor's supporters protest this week in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, I don't know that they will ever find solace in this case. It's really tragic when a young man is shot, outside a convenience store. There was a call from the convenience store to the police. That's why they got there. So we still don't know, but we just see this drumbeat across the United States where young men are being killed by police, and it's tragic. And whether or not it was warranted, I don't think the friends and family will ever feel good about this.
Another point that Chief Burbank brought up was this idea of militarization of local law enforcement, and especially in light of what we saw in Ferguson. We saw tear gas, we saw, body armor, full body armor on the cops. Burbank says, of course, that's not happening in the capital city. Although, as our colleague Nate Carlisle reported in the spring, some military surplus is making its way to Utah. So, Dan Harry, it's a trend that we're seeing even here.
Yes, it is. And, you know, you've seen incidents, particularly in SWAT situations and riot control, but we haven't had a lot of riot control here. But we have had these SWAT situations where police will break into a home, and often it's a suspected drug dealer. And the case in Ogden, I think the suspect's name was Matthew Stewart, who was there was a shootout with police, and one policeman was killed. And as it turns out, there's been a lot of questions in the wake of that because, you know, he was suspected of growing and selling marijuana. And the question was that an overreaction by the police to break in there in the middle of the night in full SWAT gear with guns drawn and ignite a situation that maybe could have been handled a different way? And there was an incident in Salt Lake City where the SWAT team went in and they broke into a house, and whoops, it was the wrong house. It was a mistake on the part of the SWAT team, an honest mistake, but nevertheless a very alarming mistake for the folks who were, you know, whose house it was, that were totally innocent and not suspected of anything. But those kinds of incidents, you know, really want to make people draw a clear line between military and police, because the missions of those two should be very different.
So in the aggregate, you take all of these shootings, you take about, you know, these raids on homes, you take the shooting of a dog, mm-hmm. and it really has put Salt Lake City Police on the defensive. George Pyle?
Yeah, well, Chief Burbank's very proud of the fact that he can negotiate his way out of situations. He's one of the few police departments in the country that didn't go after the local Occupy movement, you know, with shields and helmets and water cannons. He just kind of walked up to them one day and said, okay, you're done. And there was one death there. It wasn't from police action, and he's very proud of that. And he's has spoken out against this idea of militarizing the police. The police are supposed to be part of the community. It's the old idea of community policing, where you're not apart from the community, hiding in a tank or behind shields. You walk among the people, and yeah, you've got a pistol on your hip and you've got a taser. And the fact that, you know, our police have shot one person and one dog in the past few weeks proves that you don't have to be a fully militarized, SWAT-driven police department to occasionally have an incident like this. It happens in police work. And you question the training. You say, well, couldn't you have used a baton? Couldn't you have used a taser? Couldn't you have used pepper spray? But we weren't there. And even when you have video evidence, I mean, this is not a football game where you have 47 angles of tape that you can roll back and back and back. You have one body cam from the officer, and it may or may not show the detail, the key detail as to whether the person who was killed was armed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's crucial to this investigation. And if the video is bouncy and scratchy and out of focus, it may not resolve that question.
Hmm. So Chris, where does the investigation go from here in the Taylor case? What did the chief sort of illuminate that process?
Well, I think what typically happens in these cases is that the law enforcement agency will conduct its investigation, and then it'll turn that over to the district attorney, which in this case is Sim Gill. And then he will decide if there is enough evidence to bring charges, but I suspect that after the South Salt Lake finish the investigation, if they do not believe there's enough evidence to bring charges, that we'll know that very quickly, because I think that's something that Chief Burbank would like to get off the table as soon as he can. And so that may, you know, I'm guessing that's going to take weeks, and you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe a couple of months. Who knows?
In the meantime, do you feel like Chief Burbank still has the full faith of city leadership? Is Mayor Becker standing behind him, the city council members?
Well, certainly Mayor Becker is standing behind him, but this has been sort of the summer of discontent at the police department. One of the other big issues is this rape kit issue, where the city council is at odds with the chief, and the council is actually preparing an ordinance that would force the chief to analyze all of these forensic rape kits from each victim who reports a sexual assault. The chief says it's unnecessary, it's expensive, and it'll bog down his department. That is that big debate, and it might be something of a smackdown, is going to come in a month's time. So we'll see this sort of continuous to and fro between the city council and the chief, but the chief has been, you know, doing his best to get out there and get some public good public relations for himself, and you know, the mayor's behind him 100%.
Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart, also in the studio, editorial writer George Pyle, government editor Dan Harry, and education reporter Lisa Shanker. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. The number, 801-355-TALK. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Lisa Shanker, Christopher Smart, Dan Harry on the reporting side are here. George Pyla from the opinion page is here, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, and we're talking about the week's top stories. And you can join us. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com or call us 801-355-TALK. Let's move to schools. The Board of Education, Lisa Shanker, there's a lot of turmoil and controversy right now in that institution. Let's start with the resignations. First, who's leaving?
Sure. There's been a number of high-level resignations announced in the last few weeks. Most notably, perhaps, the Deputy State Superintendent, Brenda Hales, has sort of left already, and State Superintendent Martel Menlove is retiring, and he will probably be done in the office in the next week or two.
Okay, and why? Why did they decide, well, now's the time to make that happen?
Well, Brenda Hales told me that she had been planning to retire this year for quite some time, and Martel Menlove announced his retirement a while ago as well. I think what came as kind of a surprise was the timing of both of these. There was a closed audit committee meeting of the state school board earlier this month, and Martel Menlove was asked to leave that meeting, and that caused some controversy, I think, at the State Office of Education, and board members have acknowledged to me that may have had something to do with Brenda Hale's decision to leave, although she told me there was no one particular event. She stopped coming to work a couple weeks ago and said she would use her vacation and her other leave to carry her through until her official retirement at the end of the year. And Martel Menlove had originally said he was going to stay until they found a permanent replacement, but he'll be gone in the next week or two. I asked him if his departure, the timing of it, had to do with being asked to leave this audit committee meeting, and he didn't want to comment on that.
Okay, so a few question marks there. Then there's this letter sent by one of the members of the board alleging some misconduct. Maybe describe the contents of that letter.
Sure. Terrell Warner, one of the board members, sent an email to all the other board members Sunday night expressing her concerns with a number of things. She said there's been some allegations of fellow board members abusing their power, although she declined to go into that.
You asked her to be a little more specific. She said, mm-mm.
Sure. She said she was concerned about giving specifics because it was something discussed during a closed meeting, and so she wasn't sure what she could and couldn't reveal specifically about that allegation. She also is calling for an investigation into the board. She feels there were things discussed during closed meetings that should have been discussed during open meetings. And she also called for a full board meeting to appoint a new interim superintendent. Board leadership, just the top two people on the board, had made that decision about a week ago on their own. And some board members, including Terrell Warner, were surprised and upset that they had done that without the full board voting and not in public.
Hmm. So we've got resignations. We have accusations. Yesterday, the board appointed an interim director, but it was not unanimous. Maybe you can tell us about this interim director, Joel Coleman.
Sure. Joel Coleman, that's who board leadership decided to appoint last week. And so they just kind of confirmed their appointment of him last night. But it was a divided board. It was a 9-6 vote. And there was about an hour of debate before they approved that. There were board members concerned about Mr. Coleman as an interim superintendent, namely because his wife has a pending lawsuit against the state charter school board and a couple staffers in the State Office of Education, and also because he doesn't come from a public education background. He's the superintendent of the Utah Schools for the Deaf and Blind at the moment, but his career has been as a teacher and administrator at seminary in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and not as a public school teacher.
Interesting. So what does all of this mean for the public? I mean, we can watch from the outside and we see a little bit of controversy. Is there some sort of practical effect for the public out there?
I think it may be a little a little tumultuous for school leaders throughout the state and over the next couple months. Local district superintendents, they look to the state office for guidance, and whether they'll be able to get the guidance they need, I think, depends on how smooth this transition goes, how well Joel Coleman can head that office for the next few months.
Okay. Joel Coleman named the interim director of the State Board of Education this morning. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh is reporting that House Speaker Becky Lockhart wants that job. She wants to be the permanent appointment. Dan Harry, she was expected to run for governor. Is this a bit of a shocker?
It shocked me. That's the first I heard of it was this morning when I read Paul's column. So it does... I mean, I don't know whether it is confirmed or not, but I do know that it makes some logical sense, because if she proceeded on what everyone thought was her path to try to challenge Governor Gary Herbert, it was a very tough path for her indeed. They kind of had very well-publicized showdowns during the last session of the legislature, and it was pretty clearly Gary Herbert's victory in their crossing of swords over that. Plus, you know, he's pretty high in popularity polls. He continues to have a high good support in the public, and he is has an incredible ability to raise money for his campaign. So that would have been a very tough thing for her to try to challenge him.
George, read the tea leaves on this. Is Governor Herbert doing the happy dance? I mean, what do you make of this change in direction?
Well, in terms of Becky Lockhart, I mean, probably she had some polling done, or she sat down with a lot of county chairmen and looked around for the money people, the bundlers who she would need, found that they were all already in Gary Herbert's camp. And maybe this is speculation, but decided that a run for the governor just wasn't going to be successful unless, and especially a few weeks ago, Governor Herbert basically said it wasn't his formal announcement, but he said to a bunch of very wealthy people, "I'm running for governor again," which you have to say. You can't, I mean, we complain about the permanent campaign. But if you're going to run for anything above city council anytime in the next 2 years, you better be up and running now. You've got to raise money. You've got to line up volunteers. You've got to get a county chairman and a precinct chairman all over the state. And so you can't be late to this game, or you're not going to have a chance. Now, then the other issue is, how is this going to affect education policy? And it does seem like we're having maybe a replay of the earlier fuss about public funding going to vouchers. You have people seeking high office in the state education state education bureaucracy who are basically taking pride in the fact that they have no experience in public education, so therefore they should be allowed to run it.
And I guess, Lisa Shanker, if Joel Coleman had some trouble with his lack of public education experience, we could expect the same for Becky Lockhart. She also does not have any public ed experience.
Sure. I would expect that the same people who are concerned about Joel Coleman's lack of public ed experience would feel the same way about Speaker Lockhart.
Mm-hmm. If you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. We're talking about Board of Ed controversies right now, and we invite you to join us. Let's go to the phones, and Mary is calling from Salt Lake City. And Mary, hi.
Hi. First of all, I want to say how much I appreciate this program. I think it's terrific.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll continue with it forever.
We do too.
My question back to the state school board is basically, what kind of diversity is represented on the board? Number one, do we have any non-LDS? And number two, do we have any ethnic representation, especially the Hispanic population who are growing so fast here?
Okay. Mary, great question. Thanks very much for the call. Lisa Shanker, give us the composition of the Board of Ed.
Sure. You know, I haven't polled the board about their religious affiliations, but in terms of ethnic diversity, there's not a lot of it. I'm trying to go through the 15 board members in my mind, and I believe it may be an all-white board, although I apologize if I'm forgetting about anyone, although there are non-voting members, including a member from the Coalitions of Minorities Advisory Committee, and that is a committee focused on minorities, and so there is a minority non-voting member who attends the board meetings and comments during board meetings.
Right, quite a few women on the board.
Yes, yes.
As I suppose you could expect. All right, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Lisa, I want to stick with education for a moment. Also this week, you reported that test scores have declined. How bad is it?
Well, everybody knew that test scores were going to go down because there are new state tests for the first time this school year. And when you switch to new tests, that happens. And the tests are also testing kids on material learned based on new standards. And the standards are more rigorous than Utah's old ones. So it's no surprise that the results have gone down. Basically, the tests were in math, language arts, and science, and they show that across all the grades, fewer than half of students tested proficient in those subjects.
Ouch.
So that's much lower than on the old state tests. But proponents of the testing say, you know, this is a more realistic picture of what our kids know.
So what does proficiency mean? And what should it mean, Lisa?
Sure. I mean, it generally means that kids are performing around grade level when it comes to understanding these standards, which are just basically skills that you're expected to know in each grade.
I guess I'm still a little confused, though. So we have the SAGE test scores, which you reported on this week. The old tests were the CRTs. Were the CRTs not looking at grade level proficiency? What were they measuring?
They were. They were measuring proficiency as well. In theory, it's the same thing they were measuring. I think these tests, they're just the material that the kids are being tested on is more difficult. And the testing, it's a totally different kind of testing. It's computer adaptive. It's not, you know, A, B, C, D, multiple choice, fixed form. Well, fixed form for everyone. It's a different kind of thing.
So what do folks at the local level think about this decline? We don't have individual scores yet. Parents haven't gotten to see what their kids did on the SAGE testing. But, I mean, any sense of what parents, students are thinking about this news?
I think it'll people will react when those scores come out individually at the end of September, October. I think that's when you'll see maybe the biggest reactions when parents see their individual kids' scores and go, oh, my kid's not scoring as well as they always have. What's going on? And schools will see their scores as well, and schools will be, their grades will be based partly on those. So maybe schools, you know, they might not get as high of grades this year as they're used to.
Does this decline in test scores, does it give fuel for the Common Core debate fire? George Pyle.
Well, anything that comes along, you'll say, see, I told you, it isn't working. Well, they changed the test from one year to another, and yeah, the scores go down. I mean, really, part of the problem with testing is you keep changing the tests, not just in Utah, but every place. And so you really don't have several years of data of kids taking the same test. It's kind of like when the stock splits or something. You have to go back and adjust for it somehow. And is it really a proper trend? And we had more trouble with this a few years ago when No Child Behind came along. And the best thing about No Child Left Behind was it made states and school districts stop hiding the low scores of the non-English speakers and the ethnic minorities into the overall score that may have been higher. They made them break it out by ethnic group and by school and by non-English speaker. And that helped show, yeah, these kids are doing fine. These kids are, well, being left behind. And you need to do something about it. You need to have a kind of a trend. But anytime anybody comes up with any kind of reform, then you have all these people who maybe haven't even read the reforms, who just automatically run to the battlements and say, no, this is federal control. No, it isn't. It's state control. Well, we don't even like state control. We only like local control. And again, we have people who come along and wave as a credential the fact that they have no experience in public education, because there are so many people who don't trust public education because, one, it might be indoctrinating your kids, or two, it might not be.
Lisa, so, I mean, how are Common Core supporters looking at this information? Are they using it?
I think they see it as a validation that they can look at these scores and, like George said, say, see, we told you so. This is not good. Our kids are not learning. But, you know, I think the people who are proponents of the Common Core will say this was to be expected. This is what happens when you give kids more difficult material, and it's a good thing.
Hmm. Story continues to develop. Lisa Schenker with the Salt Lake Tribune. Let's move on from the schoolhouse to the ski slopes. Park City Mountain Resort and Vail are still at the negotiating table trying to work out some sort of settlement. Chris Smart, just briefly, what's at the heart of this case?
Well, this litigation has now been going on 3 years. And at the heart of the case is that Park City Mountain Resort leased ski terrain from Talisker Land Holdings, which also owns the Canyons Resort. And 3 years ago, the Park City Mountain Resort missed its lease renewal deadline. It got to renew every 20 years. It's like, oops. It's somebody in George's department called it the most monumental blunder in Utah business history. And so the deal was that PCMR was getting this lease rate that was very low, and they were making a lot of money. And Talisker leased the Canyons to Vail for $25 million a year, with the expectation for Vail that they may also get to operate Park City Mountain Resort. So the two have been fighting it out. The Vail Talisker seems to have come out ahead so far in the litigation. That would, but Park City's digging in its heels. It doesn't own all of the ski terrain, but it does own and operate the base. Without that, you can't run a ski resort. So it looks like, unless they reach some kind of a deal, that the resort wouldn't open this year. That has the town folk in Park City tearing their hair out.
Of course, because it's not just the ski resort identity. It's their economy that's at stake.
Yeah, I mean, it's just huge for those folks who are not only the employees of Park City Mountain Resort, but who own restaurants or ski shops or T-shirt shops and the people who work in those shops, not to mention the hotels. So it's a very big deal, and right now the two sides are in mediation. The deadline for mediation is August 24th. There's also an offer made by Vail that if Park City were to come up with a bond, that it could continue to operate the ski resort this season and through coming litigation, because Park City has said it will appeal to the Utah Supreme Court. But the amount of the bond is in question. So, of course, Park City Mountain Resort wants a low bond. Vail wants a high bond, and that is going to be the subject of a court hearing on the 27th of August. So things are coming to something of a head. I think this bond issue is very important for the residents of Park City. It could keep the Park City Resort open this winter. But it's still just a big uncertain mess, but it looks like at this point that Vail has the upper hand.
George, from the outside, what's going to happen here? Who's going to call Uncle?
Well, you have to, and Talisker's Vail, they're going to have to stop and think for themselves. You know, is it really to their advantage to shut down the neighboring ski resort? Does that mean they get all the business? Or does that mean this wave goes across the country that says Park City shut down this year? Because people operate on rumors and hearsay and tweets and things, and they may not understand that the Canyons is still open. They may not understand that the Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons are still open. So Utah as a whole might not lose very much business. But this is really bad for Park City's reputation, and it just comes down to, you know, as you say, who's going to blink first? And again, looking at it from the outside, as we all are, who forgot to renew the lease? Isn't that basic? Shouldn't you have a big klaxon on your thing that says renew the lease. You've got no business without it. And you do have, like, the mayor of Park City and other people saying, come on, you guys, work this out. And it really would be in the interest of everybody, you'd think, to work it out. Is it really in Vail's interest to play such hardball that the neighboring resort shuts down for a year, and then, you know, maybe they think they get to pick it up and run it next year? Or is that just going to be bad for the whole Utah ski industry?
Mm. Chris Smart, you will be busy as these deadlines approach. Christopher Smart from the Salt Lake Tribune. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be right back. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson, studio with Chris Smart, Lisa Shanker, Dan Harry, and George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. Short and sweet summary, Dan, on a story that our colleague Lee Davidson reported. UTA officials getting compensated handsomely and even more handsomely than we thought. What's the story?
Yeah, we've been talking about several oopses this morning, and there was one on the part of UTA that they had underreported their compensation for employees. And the total was, I think, $14.6 million that they'd underreported the retirement pensions that they were paying employees. And, you know, the highest paid executives at UTA got a substantial amount of that, including Mike Allegra, the CEO, general manager, and president, I believe is his title.
So previously we knew their salaries, but we did not know the full package, the retirement benefits, and that adds quite a bit of change.
So, for instance, with Allegra, his total compensation package increased by something like $50,000 with this report, so that it's close to $400,000 a year total compensation. And, you know, this is a sensitive issue because critics have long said that the salaries at UTA and the bonuses, because they do award bonuses, are out of line with what the local economy is, and UTA continues to justify that and say, you know, that's what they need to pay to get the best and the brightest, and they say they have the best and the brightest, but certainly this just increased that controversy a little bit more.
And do you think lawmakers will take up the scrutiny again? They have in the past.
I don't know. There is an audit that the legislature has ordered into the UTA, and that's going to be released next week. And I know that Lee, who had talked to UTA, said they didn't seem particularly concerned about what that audit is going to say. But I think that salaries and compensation may be one of the issues looked at there. And they have been, the legislature has been critical of that in the past.
Okay. We'll continue to watch that at the Tribune, of course. A time for our underplayed story of the week, the story that's going to continue to develop and capture our attention. George Pyle, what's your pick for the week?
Well, we talked a lot about police officers earlier, and one thing that we didn't talk about, and this got the play it deserved for the day, and I hope it will continue to be an issue, is they announced this huge series of heroin busts that they engaged in, and they had more police brass in one room than you've ever seen. But at the same time, there was no grand celebration, no mission accomplished banner. There was the admission that we have made a dent in a market that is never ending and that we cannot arrest our way out of. If you want to deal with drug problems, you've got to deal with the demand, you've got to deal with training, education, rehabilitation, treatment, in prison and out, if you want to have a half a chance of dealing with this. And they were very frank about admitting that, and I think that speaks well for the law enforcement establishment around here.
Pretty sobering information. Okay, Chris Smart.
My underreported story is that the University of Utah has extended its shuttle down 1500 East, and Salt Lake City is looking at the University of Utah as a partner in mass transit. that this idea is in its infantile stages, but it kind of goes back to UTA again, because the Salt Lake City neighborhoods have been clamoring for bus service for the past half dozen years as UTA has focused on rail. UTA in the last couple of weeks has sort of given voice to the fact that they understand that they need to expand their bus service. So the question is, you know, for Salt Lake City anyway, is how does that happen, because we really need it.
Mm. Okay, downtown and the adjacent neighborhoods, transportation. We'll continue to watch that. Lisa Shanker?
Mine's a UTA story, too. I don't know that it was underplayed, but I thought Lee Davidson's story about the Sugar House streetcar line was really interesting. And I look forward to seeing how that develops as the city continues to, you know, expand and decide how to do that, to see whether this is something that's actually needed, whether people actually want this.
The story essentially, ridership, not so great, economic development potential, really good.
Right. And so I thought that was kind of a interesting double-edged sword there.
Okay. Dan Harry, your pick.
Okay, I'm going to pick a national story. The Bank of America, which just settled, I think, for $17 billion for some of its kind of misdeeds in the housing crisis. And that has a particular strikes a chord in Utah, because if you recall, that is sort of one of the most egregious allegations in the Swallow Shirtlift scandal, is that the state dropped a class action lawsuit against Bank of America as Mark Shirtlift was negotiating a job with a law firm that represents that bank as he was leaving office. Nothing's been proven that, you know, there was wrongdoing there, but that allegation exists and is part of the charges.
I think you're right. It's shocking to people when they hear that.
Yeah, and the reason that strikes a chord so much, I think, is because it shows more than any of the other alleged scandals that the activities that are alleged to have gone on hurt real people. They had an effect on real people beyond just, you know, the elite political circle doing these misdeeds.
Mm. It's a good story. And yes, we will continue to follow the Shirtlift Swallow saga as it proceeds through the courts. My underplayed story of the week is one that Brian Maffley broke yesterday, that a Utah-based company has found a partner. Westinghouse Electric says it's going to partner with Blue Castle to build a nuclear power plant just outside of Green River. Now, the question of water allocation, will they get it? It's still in litigation, so it's not a done deal. But this is certainly a step closer to nuclear power coming into Utah, and I think this is a story that we will see and hear a lot about. And I'm going to leave it there. Dan Harry, Lisa Shanker, Chris Smart, and George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And we're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week he takes us on to a very serious topic, suicide.
This was back in 2006, and I had recently had a former coworker kill himself, commit suicide.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and his wife found his body. And I thought how tragic that was, that her last memory would be of him in that condition. And I was really angry about it to some respect, and wanted to say something to people who might be thinking about killing themselves, that you really need to rethink what this is going to do to the people you love, because it's usually the people who love you that go looking for you in the first place. Mm. You know, where's dad, and where's mom, where's grandpa? And having been a police officer, I have a long history of visiting homes where people made nightmares out of themselves and have to pick up the pieces of the living that have seen this.
Read a bit, if you would.
Just because someone does something horrible doesn't mean that they couldn't help it. It means they arrived at the point where what they wanted was more important to them than what other people deserved, including those who loved them. Sometimes It's deliberate. I sat with a corpse once and read his journal while we waited for the medical examiner. The last entry was, "I hope the insurance makes you happy." The guy had been lucid enough to drive to his former living room and put the muzzle of a deer rifle into his mouth, believing that the next person who found him would be his estranged wife. He was wrong. It was his 10-year-old daughter, and she didn't give a damn about the insurance.
What was the response to this?
The initial response was negative in that I was sort of putting the onus onto people who couldn't really help it because they were mentally ill. Mm. And my experience with suicide had largely been because of selfish reasons rather than they were, you know, typically they were no more depressed or crazy than I was, which is not really saying all that much. But they were lucid enough to know that what they were doing was going to have an impact on the people who would find them, their children and things like that. And so I was, this column was essentially a plea. Look, give this another think while you still can, because if you really don't want to leave them with this nightmare, figure out a different way. I mean, it's not like eternity is going to leave without you. Give it a second thought. And initially the response was a little punishing because counselors and people like that, or somebody who'd had their loved one kill himself, thought that I was actually making fun of suicide victims. The true victims are the ones who are left behind. And then I started getting mail from counselors who say, I wish I could say it this plainly to the people that I counsel. You know, you're being selfish. Stop thinking that way. And ended up winning an award from the SPJ.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and there's more Kirby at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, the show produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.